You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's early evening on July 4th, 1908. In the middle of a vast open field, a crew of men is carefully wheeling a strange machine onto a makeshift runway. The machine has broad, yellow wings made from fabric and bamboo, and a long body that teeters on three bicycle wheels. People have been gathering here since dawn, waiting for this very moment. Now, all along the runway, thousands of spectators clamor for a better look.
Oh, there it is. Wow, would you look at that. Hey, let me see.
The reason everyone's here? They've come to witness the impossible. Scientific American has offered a silver trophy to the first machine that can prove it's capable of flying. The statue's silver alone is said to be worth $2,500. But for the winner, its significance is immeasurably more valuable. For centuries, people have dreamed about flying, and many have tried. But few of the spectators here have ever seen a machine make it off the ground, let alone fly the 1 kilometer distance required to win the trophy. Today, at long last, this crowd will see if such a machine is real or still just the stuff of fantasy. Among the spectators, skepticism runs high, perhaps nowhere so much as in the reporter's box.
That thing looks like it's made from toothpicks. No wonder they waited out the wind. Circus. If flying machines were real, I think we'd know by now. Anyway, we'll know soon enough. Looks like they're finally getting started.
The crowd begins to settle as the pilot climbs into his seat. He straps himself in and starts the engine. The propeller whirls, and the craft starts rolling down the runway. Faster and faster it goes, bumping up and down, building speed until...
My God! It's lifting off.
The crowd watches in awe as the fragile plane continues to rise, banking higher and higher. And then, suddenly, something's wrong. The pilot cuts the engine, and the plane glides back to the ground. As the pit crew rushes across the field to meet their grounded pilot, back in the press box, the reporters trade satisfied glances.
What did I tell you? It couldn't even get halfway there. Hey, it looks like... Are they going to try again? They won't have time. It's already getting dark.
The pilot and its crew roll the plane back to the runway. They make some kind of small adjustment to the tail section, and the pilot jumps back in. Once again, he starts the engine. The craft accelerates, and the takeoff looks the same. Only this time, the plane doesn't go as high. It lifts cleanly into the air and soars forward, moving closer and closer to the 1 kilometer mark, and then right past it. The crowd goes wild. The plane lands gracefully in a field, nearly 2,000 feet past the mark. When it finally comes to a stop, the pilot jumps out and turns to face the crowd, wearing a smile that stretches from ear to ear. The crew rushes to his side. Spectators swarm the runway. Everyone is hugging, laughing, and cheering. The energy is explosive. Even the reporters are excited.
I don't believe my eyes, folks. Finally, man has conquered the sky.
The first ever public flight would capture the imagination of the country and usher in the dawn of a new age of aviation. And the Wright brothers, the men most closely associated with the airplane, weren't even there. The pilot of the plane was a man named Glenn Curtis, a 30-year-old motorcycle manufacturer from upstate New York. Over the course of his life, Curtis would go on to make more contributions to airplane technology than any other man before or since. And yet, his story, the real story of early aviation, has been all but erased from popular history.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Hey, it's Steven Johnson. I've got some really exciting news. You can now listen to our back catalog and new episodes of the show completely ad-free on Stitcher Premium. In addition to our ad-free episodes, you can also listen to tons of other ad-free Wondery shows. Plus, with Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of original content, audio documentaries, and exclusive bonus episodes from some of your other favorite podcasts. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Then once you're signed up, just download the Stitcher app for iOS or Android and start listening. That's stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and promo code Wondery.
From Wondery, this is American Innovations, and I'm Steven Johnson. Think for a moment about some of the pioneering developments from the earliest days of American aviation. The first flight from one city to another, the first airplane sold commercially, the first pilot's license. If you ask practically anyone today, more than a century later, they'll likely tell you these milestones were achieved by the Wright brothers, the legendary team that most of us associate with the dawn of aviation. But it turns out the Wright brothers were responsible for none of these firsts. In fact, all of these achievements belong to just one man, Glenn Hammond Curtiss, the father of modern aviation. Over the course of his life, Curtiss made hundreds of path-breaking aeronautical innovations, including many that are still used in airplanes today, from wing flaps and tricycle landing gear to the enclosed cockpit and the pontoons used on seaplanes. And he did it all without so much as a high school education. So why is it that most Americans have never heard his name? To answer that question, this series will look back at the early days of aviation, at the race to design, refine, and manufacture a manned flying machine, and at the bitter rivalry that robbed Curtiss of his rightful place in history as the greatest aviator and aeronautical inventor of all time. This is Episode 1, Flight of the Junebug. It's May 30, 1903, Memorial Day. 25-year-old Glenn Curtiss saddles up on a motorcycle of his own design. He calls the model Hercules, though it appears to be little more than a bicycle with an engine attached. But rumor has it that his two-cylinder engine packs all the power of its mythic namesake. And today, in Yonkers, New York, Curtiss will have the chance to prove it. A 10-mile race against the fastest motorcyclists in the country. Curtiss takes his position at the starting line. Dressed in a turtleneck and slacks, he looks more like he's ready for an evening stroll than a motorcycle race. But his cool and focused demeanor tells a different story. Curtiss folds his lithe frame over the machine and waits for a signal. On that day, Curtiss did more than win a race. He officially became the American motorcycle champion and set a world speed record in the process of 56 seconds per mile. Practically overnight,
Curtis became the most sought-after motorcycle engineer in the country. As orders began pouring in, Curtis's modest bicycle shop in Hammondsport, New York, was transformed into an impressive manufacturing operation. Ironically, Curtis had no engineering training. In fact, his formal education never went beyond eighth grade. But he had a natural talent for working with machines and a feel for how to improve them. And nowhere was this more evident than in his engines. From his very first engine that actually used tomato cans for both the carburetor and the gas tank, Curtis's engine designs had evolved to become among the most lightweight and powerful in the world. A critical combination for would-be speedsters and, as it turns out, for would-be aviators as well. One day in 1904, Curtis's lightweight engines happened to catch the attention of an aviation daredevil called Captain Thomas Baldwin. What he was captain of, no one could be sure. At one time, he'd been a tightrope walker in the circus, but he had left the big top to travel the country exhibiting his blimp to crowds eager for flight. On this particular day, the captain was building his new airship on a ranch in California when a young man rode by on a new Hercules motorcycle. Baldwin was instantly struck by the idea that the compact motorcycle engine was exactly what he needed to power his airship. Despite being a rather portly man, Captain Baldwin chased the rider down to inquire about the engine.
Young man, your engine, where is it from? G.H. Curtis Manufacturing Company.
When he learned where the motor came from, he immediately wired an order for an identical one and fitted it to his dirigible. That year, Captain Baldwin entered his airship, powered by a Curtis motor, in the St. Louis World's Fair. When it won top honors, Baldwin didn't just place another order. He took a train directly to Hammondsport, New York, to meet Curtis in person.
I'm looking for the residence of G.H. Curtis. This is it. How can I help you? I'd like to speak to Mr. Curtis himself, if he's at home. He is, and you're already speaking to him.
The captain couldn't believe the lanky, unassuming 25-year-old man in front of him was G.H. Curtis. But if Captain Baldwin was surprised by Curtis, Curtis was even more surprised by Captain Baldwin. Curtis had been a bit skeptical about aviation. At this point in the early 20th century, nobody was really talking about airplanes. They mostly talked about airships, which relied on low-density gases and the buoyancy principle to get up in the air, instead of wings and more complicated Newtonian physics. Travel in the air was the domain of a colorful array of balloons and blimps manned by equally colorful men, outsiders, wealthy eccentrics, and showmen. Men, in other words, like Captain Baldwin. But as Captain Baldwin recounted stories about traveling the country in his airship and his recent success in St. Louis, Curtis began to change his thinking about aviation. The pair developed a fast friendship that blossomed into a close working collaboration. The captain grandly predicted that Curtis's engines would soon power airships around the world. And over the next 2 years, a massive new influx of orders for airship engines would prove him right. Thanks to the captain, Curtis was beginning to find a whole new market for his engines. Soon, virtually all dirigible balloons in the U.S. would be driven by Curtis motors. Then, in 1906, Captain Baldwin invited Curtis to join him at a big exhibition in Dayton, Ohio, where the Wright brothers were said to live. Curtis had heard rumors that the brothers had secured a key aviation patent and were developing a flying machine that didn't need hot air or hydrogen gas to get aloft. Nobody had ever seen them fly, but if Captain Baldwin was interested in Curtis's engines, he thought, perhaps the Wright brothers would be too. It's a blustery September day in Dayton, Ohio. Men are literally holding on to their hats. Women are struggling to hold down their skirts. But the crowd at the city fairgrounds will not be deterred. Today's top attraction is too good to miss. Any minute now, Captain Baldwin is scheduled to demonstrate his new airship, a dirigible named City of Los Angeles, powered by a custom Glenn Curtis motor. The demonstration like everything the captain does, promises to be thrilling. The captain struts out onto the platform and strikes a proud pose in front of the crowd. In tall boots and a dark cape, he looks like a circus ringmaster.
Are you ready for a show? Then let's start the countdown. 60 seconds.
Curtis is standing off to one side, seriously concerned about the weather. He looks up at the sky and then walks over to Captain Baldwin.
Captain, you can't fly now. My motor's not powerful enough to fight against those winds.
40 seconds.
Nonsense. I've flown in worse. And look at this crowd. I'm not about to disappoint them.
30 seconds.
You keep the countdown going. Make it loud and clear. I'm heading up.
Curtis counts down to himself. 10, 9, 8. But before the heavy man can clamber onto the ship, a strong gust blows the airship loose. The crowd watches dumbfounded as Baldwin's craft begins to drift swiftly and inexorably away from the fairgrounds.
Glenn, my boy, I may have been mistaken.
Curtis sprints to catch up.
Quick, we need to grab those tethering lines.
Two young spectators race over to help him. Together, they grab hold of the lines and, straining against the winds, begin to pull the craft back towards its dock. After a great deal of effort, they manage to return the dirigible to its mooring. Curtis offers the young man his hand in thanks.
Oh, thank you both. I couldn't have gotten it back without your help. I'm Glenn Curtis. Always happy to help a fellow aviator. My name's Orville Wright, and this is my brother Wilbur. Ta! That's incredible. You two gentlemen are a big part of the reason why I agreed to join Captain Baldwin on this trip. I was hoping to meet you. Wasn't expecting to do it like this, though.
To anyone passing by, the three young men might have appeared to be triplets. With their lanky frames and thin, serious faces, the three of them bore a striking resemblance to each other. And later that day, the men would discover they had other similarities as well. With the airship securely tethered, the Wright brothers invited Curtis and Captain Baldwin to join them at their bicycle shop. With workbenches, tools, and bicycle rims hanging from the rafters, the place felt remarkably like Curtis's own original bicycle shop in Hammondsport. Curtis felt immediately at home. Over the course of the evening, Curtis was surprised to find the Wrights were also very much like him in temperament. All three of them tended to be shy and reserved, and they excelled at the same kind of hands-on thinking. Even more surprising, none of them had received any kind of formal engineering training. But while Curtis was open and candid, always ready to share new ideas with colleagues, the Wright brothers were a self-contained unit. They valued their privacy above all else and felt deeply mistrustful of outsiders. It had been 3 years since the brothers successfully flew their airplane at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and they had even been issued a broad patent for the machine. But still, only a handful of people had ever seen them fly it. And while they initially hit it off with Curtis, they were still guarded with their guests. The fact was, all across the country, people and institutions like the Aero Club of America and Scientific American magazine had offered the brothers recognition and prizes to coax them into exhibiting their flying machine. But the Wrights refused all of them. It was partly because they were private and mistrusting by nature, but it also stemmed from the fact that they thought that they had a big lead on the competition and sought to gain as much control of the technology as possible. So, for years on end, they continued working in secret and kept their plane hidden from view in a barn not far from where the brothers sat chatting with their new friends late into the night. Back home in Hammondsport, Curtis sent a warm and chatty letter to his new friends, the Wright brothers, offering to send them one of his latest engines, free of charge, for their airplanes. Wilbur wrote back promptly.
We will remember your visit to Dayton with pleasure. The experience we had together in helping Captain Baldwin back to the fairgrounds is not one soon to be forgotten.
But he went on to decline Curtis's offer, even though he would later admit that the weakest component of the original Wright Flyer was its engine. Years later, this polite correspondence would give way to outright animosity. Orville Wright would ultimately charge that this chance meeting in Dayton was part of a systematic effort by Curtis to steal the Wrights' technology. While there's virtually no evidence to substantiate Orville's claim, he was right about one thing. The field of aviation was indeed heating up. Some of the greatest scientists and engineers in the country were beginning to work on their own flying machines. And Glenn Curtis was about to find himself face to face with one of the greatest of them all.
Say hello to a new era of mental health care. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support 100% online. You'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. Your Cerebral therapist or prescriber will outline a customized plan with clear milestones along the way so you can get to feeling your best. With Cerebral, you're not alone in your mental health journey. We're here to empower you to live a fulfilling life. So take that first step towards a brighter future and sign up today at Cerebral.com/podcast and use code WONDERY to get 15% off your first month. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. Offer ends July 31st, 2024. See site for details.
It's January 1906, the New York Auto Show. In the vast exhibition hall, Glenn Curtis stands at his booth beside a row of his lightweight motors, answering questions from interested buyers.
Yes, sir. These models have been designed specifically for airships. Well, thank you for your interest.
He's been exhibiting here for years, but this year, things feel different. The event's organizers have invited the city's fledgling Aero Club to participate for the first time ever. Curtis even tweaked his customary exhibit in honor of the auto show's new participants, adding emphasis on dirigibles. But from the look of things, it seems he's underestimated the crowd's newfound interest in aviation. Some of the top aviators in the country are in attendance, and they brought prime examples of their work. No fewer than four dirigibles hang suspended from the ceiling, including the latest from Captain Baldwin. The committee had written an appeal to the Wright brothers to come and display their airplane as well. Not surprisingly, the Wrights declined. "Sending a whole aircraft would interfere with our plans," they said. But they did agree to send two exceedingly plain parts from their machine for display, so as not to leave the organizers completely empty-handed: a crankshaft and flywheel from their 1903 engine. Over the course of the day, Curtis spoke with dozens of aviation enthusiasts, each one more certain about the future of flight than the last. But for Curtis, the whole idea of airplanes still felt very much like a fantasy. Then, in the afternoon, Curtis noticed an older gentleman inspecting his lightweight engines quite closely. His bushy white beard was practically dusting the table.
Can I help you, sir?
The man looks up at Curtis with a kind smile.
Glenn Curtis, it's a pleasure to meet you. I've heard about your engines. Was hoping you'd be here so I'd have a chance to see a few in person. Thank you, sir. I don't know if you've seen my booth, but I'm displaying some experiments with tetrahedral kites. I think they might just be the key to unlocking heavier-than-air flight. You may have heard my speech about it at the Aero Club's banquet.
No, sir. I'm afraid I missed that.
Well, as I told them, I'm convinced that while these dirigibles are all the rage, we're on the cusp of something much more important: heavier-than-air flying crafts that don't need hot air or hydrogen gas to get aloft. I'm well aware that many people remain skeptical.
Curtis is, in fact, one of those people. But he simply smiles politely and lets the man continue talking.
Yet I'm quite sure the day is coming when people will be able to fly over the Atlantic. You mark my words. Soon people will be able to start the day in New York and end the day in London. And after some research, I think your engines could be just the thing I need to power my kites to prove it. Think it over. I'll wire you soon.
Thank you, sir.
The man hands him his business card and disappears into the crowd. It's only once he's gone that Curtis actually reads what it says. The man who's promised to contact Curtis is none other than Alan.
Alexander Graham Bell?
Curtis didn't know it yet, but Bell was hatching a plan. The inventor of the telephone had set his sights on building a workable flying machine, but he knew he couldn't do it alone. To make his dream a reality, Bell would have to assemble a team of the most talented engineers in the country. And Curtis, a man with no more than an 8th grade education, would play a central role on that team. True to his word, Bell wired Curtis soon after the show and placed an order for one of Curtis's most powerful engines. But it came with a catch. Curtis had to hand-deliver the engine to Bell's summer laboratory in Nova Scotia, more than 1,000 miles from Hammondsport. That's how Curtis found himself on a 2-day train ride, being carried north by one machine that changed the world, and on his way to help invent another. As Curtis traveled to Bell's laboratory, he had time to think about Bell's wild predictions. Bell was convinced that one day soon, heavier-than-air machines would be able to carry people across the Atlantic in a single day. Today, we call them airplanes. But in the early 20th century, most people doubted heavier-than-air flight was even possible. A few years earlier, a Harvard-trained astronomer named Simon Newcomb had published a widely read scientific paper explaining why the dream of heavier-than-air human flight could never become a reality. Newcomb's argument rested on something called the law of the cube, the principle that an object's volume increases at a dramatically faster rate than its surface area. As Newcomb noted, when a three-dimensional object grows in size, its volume increases by the cube, that is to say, by the product of all three of its spatial dimensions, height, width, and depth. But its surface area increases by the square, that is, by the product of its height and its width. In other words, each increase in mass would vastly outstrip each increase in surface area. But for an aircraft, it's the surface areas that really matter. An aircraft needs proportionally large surface areas to stay aloft, which creates something of a paradox. The larger an aircraft becomes, the smaller its surface areas also become relative to its volume. So while it might be possible to get a bird-sized model aloft, the task of building a full-scale airplane capable of carrying a person would be exponentially more challenging, if not entirely impossible. Still, Curtis thought, if it could be done, wouldn't Alexander Graham Bell be the man to do it? With the invention of the telephone, Bell had already transformed the world once. What's to say he couldn't do it again? When Curtis's train finally pulled into the station, Bell's assistants were there waiting to greet him. Together, they loaded the engine onto the ferry to Bell's estate. Bell had named the property Ben Bria, meaning beautiful mountain in his native Gaelic. And as the boat pulled closer to the grounds, Curtis began to understand why. Ben Bria was a magical place. Situated on 1,000 acres of unspoiled scenery, the estate was part mansion, part research facility. It combined the pleasures of a summer camp with the excitement of a fast-track engineering laboratory. Curtis was in heaven. Over the course of his week-long stay, Curtis worked closely with other aviation experts and engineers in residence. He spent his days running propeller tests and teaching the others about his engine. Then at sundown, the whole group would retire to the Great Hall, where they'd play with Bell's grandchildren and drink tea. The evening would include long and stimulating conversations, as well as spirited bouts of singing. Bell loved to sing and had an excellent voice, and both he and his wife Mabel played the piano. Despite being the only member of the group without an advanced degree, Curtis fit right in. Bell had brought 2 eager young engineers onto the team, as well as Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge, the U.S. Army's leading aviation expert. But all of them deferred to Curtis's knowledge of engine design and his experience as a manufacturer. The group's members' skills were well matched. On Curtis's last day at the estate, Bell made a formal proposal.
As many of you know, I've been most keen to tackle the problem of heavier-than-air flight. And this week, I believe I've assembled a group with just the right combination of talents and know-how to do it. It will take time and money, but my dear wife, Mabel, has generously offered to sell a piece of property she owns in Washington, D.C. to supply our efforts with the needed startup capital. Mabel takes her husband's hand. But I should warn you, gentlemen, this is a man who, on our honeymoon, took all the sugar cubes from the table and dropped each and every one of them into his coffee because he was so curious about the bubbles they'd make. I'm counting on all of you to keep him on track. Despite my wife's cautionary invitation, I hope this week is not our last working together. So, in that spirit, I'd like to make two toasts. First, to Mabel.
To Mabel.
Mabel. Mabel.
And second, to the start of the Aerial Experiment Association. We can call it the AEA.
To the AEA.
To the AEA.
AEA.
Curtis returned home to Hammondsport, a changed man. He had always prided himself on being a practical man who could look at a machine and figure out how to make it work better. But after 1 week with Bell, Curtis was beginning to understand the appeal of reaching further, of tackling ideas that could fundamentally change the world, even if they seemed wild to others. Still, Curtis had a few major doubts about joining Bell's Aerial Experiment Association. First, the work would take Curtis away from his motorcycle business for at least a year. Second, although the association was offering him a salary, as an association dedicated to experimentation, he could expect little to no direct profit from the work. And third, the whole idea of a flying machine still seemed pretty impossible. Curtis chewed it over for a week before wiring to notify Bell of his decision.
I have given the association plan considerable thought and would very much like to count myself among its members.
He then wrote his old friend, Wilbur Wright, to share the exciting news. Wilbur's response was blandly polite. But in the letter to another friend, Wilbur dismissed the AEA as inconsequential rivals. An independent solution to the flying problem is at least 5 years away, Wilbur wrote. But history would show that Wilbur greatly underestimated Bell's new team. Thanks to Curtis's engine, Bell's shrewd oversight, and the group's commitment to collaboration, the AEA wouldn't need 5 years to develop a working airplane. In fact, the AEA would only need 5 months.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
It's December 1907. After just 9 short weeks at Ben Bria, the AEA has already built its first glider, a piloted kite based on one of Bell's designs. They're calling her the Cygnet, and today they'll see if it can fly. The team carries the Cygnet down to the dock and runs a tow line from the glider to a steamboat waiting on the lake. Until the Cygnet proves it can fly, the steamer will be its temporary engine. As Bell prepares the steamer, Lieutenant Thomas Selfridge straps himself into the pilot's seat. With the 50-foot-wide aluminum frame and over 3,000 hollow, pyramid-shaped cells, the glider looks more like an oversized triangular honeycomb than a plane. Curtis calls out to Selfridge.
Are you sure you want to do this?
Selfridge just laughs. An aviation expert in the U.S. Army, he's been in much more dangerous situations.
Worst case scenario, the Cygnet falls to pieces and I plunge into the icy lake below. The fall is much less likely to kill me than the cold.
The steamer starts to pull away from the dock.
and the signet bobs behind it. And then, sure enough, inch by inch, the signet starts rising upward until it's gliding 168 feet above the steamer. Bell calls to the men from the dock.
Cut the tow line. Cut it before you slow down.
But the men on board are too busy slapping each other's backs and laughing. None of them expected their very first design to fly. As the boat begins to slow, the glider loses its lift and gently lands on the water, but then gets yanked violently forward, dragged roughly through the water by its tether until it tips over and breaks. The signet is damaged beyond repair. Lieutenant Selfridge dove clear just in time to escape injury. He would oversee the AEA's next attempt. After the signet's test run, Selfridge was able to nudge the group away from Bell's overly complex design. Instead, he suggested a biplane design, long championed by early aerial experimenters. He also suggested that they relocate the group's operations from Ben Bria to Curtis's motorcycle shop in Hammondsport. After months of working outdoors in winter in Nova Scotia, the group had had enough of sub-zero temperatures. In Hammondsport, the AEA could take advantage of both the milder climate and the large number of aviation experts who had moved into town. Unlike the Wrights, the AEA had no intention of working as a self-contained unit. Their greatest strength lay in the diversity of their ideas and expertise. They approached the process of building a working plane like a collaborative relay race. In each new iteration of their designs, one team member would take the lead, going as far as he could, and then pass the baton off to another, and the process would repeat itself. That attitude was especially important given how much the AEA still needed to learn. Over the next few months, they would have to master the finer points of airplane construction, from laminating wood to welding metal. After just 3 months of construction, the second design was ready. The group called it Red Wing because of the red silk they used to line its wings. On March 12, 1908, before a handful of friends and acquaintances, Red Wing rose to a height of about 10 feet off the ground, flying for about 30 yards before its tail buckled. The aircraft had accomplished no more than a large hop, but the group was elated. 5 days later, a gust of wind upended the Red Wing and destroyed it. But by now, the AEA knew it was on a promising path. The group called its next design White Wing, and it too would be a motor-powered biplane. This time, they hit a new level of intensity as Casey Baldwin, no relation to the captain, led the team. Every evening, they held discussions in the annex of Curtis's shop, which they dubbed the Thinkorium. They debated every detail, airfoils, engine refinements, landing gear. The most pressing conversations, however, revolved around the problem of lateral control, the way the pilot controlled the aircraft's side-to-side motion. They knew the Wrights had patented a solution called wing warping, using wires to actually bend the fragile wings of their airplane while in flight. But the AEA chose to go in a different direction. Inspired by Bell's research on bird flight, they decided to add flaps to the plane's wings to allow the pilot to stabilize the plane in flight. Now known as ailerons, or French for little wings, these flaps remain a feature of almost every modern airplane. On May 18, 1908, the AEA took White Wing out for its first flight. It flew a distance of 85 meters. When Curtis took his first turn as pilot 2 days later, on his 30th birthday, he set a new record for the AEA, 310 meters. But, like its fragile predecessors, the aircraft wouldn't last long. It made just 7 flights before crashing and being too damaged to repair. It was Curtis's turn to lead the next design, which Bell would name Junebug. And this aircraft would change the course of aviation history. He had let the other men take charge of the first 3 prototypes. Despite the group's closeness, Curtis had never been able to forget that he was its only member without an advanced degree. But he'd kept close track of the mistakes made by each previous model. And now Curtis was ready to step up to the plate. Everyone in this group already knew he was a quick study and a brilliant engineer. But his work on the Junebug would prove it. Curtis built his plane upon the group's previous designs, but he also introduced several important modifications. First, he lengthened the airplane's body to improve its horizontal front-to-rear stability. Then he refined the ailerons, including a newly designed yoke that fit over the pilot's shoulders. With this method, the pilot would be able to keep the airplane from rolling out of control simply by leaning side to side. And for the finishing touch, Curtis gave the plane his shop's largest motor yet, a 40-horsepower, 8-cylinder, 200-pound engine. As the AEA worked on its newest and most promising design so far, the Scientific American Prize was never far from their minds. In the fall of 1907, soon after the AEA's first official meeting, the magazine had announced its prize for the first airplane in America that could remain airborne for 1 kilometer. After their first test flight with the Junebug, the AEA immediately threw their hat into the ring. On June 24, 1908, they telegrammed Scientific American magazine to say that the Junebug would be ready to compete for the trophy in 10 days' time. To win the grand prize, all they'd have to do is fly the Junebug 1 kilometer. There was just one problem. While the team was confident that the Junebug could fly, they had no idea if she could go the distance. It's July 3rd, just one day before the competition, and the Junebug is airborne. But something's wrong. Selfridge rushes over to the crash site.
Glenn, are you okay?
I think so. I'm in one piece, but oh, the plane. It looks like the wing is broken clear in half, and the front control, it's smashed. We'll have to call the judges to postpone. No, we can't. They're already on their way. Glenn, look at the wheel. Even that got twisted in half. We'll go straight to the shop and rebuild the wing, and we've got plenty of extra fabric. And we'll use a new wheel. I know I've got a replacement somewhere. Glenn, start talking sense. The demonstration is tomorrow. Even if we could get it done, we won't have time to test it. It's okay. We've always worked fast. Now we'll just work faster.
Together, on the eve of the Scientific American demonstration, Curtis and Selfridge rolled the damaged Junebug back into its tent. While the other members of the AEA debated what to do next, Curtis quietly began to make repairs. His determination was infectious. Soon, everyone was racing to and from the shop to repair the Junebug's broken parts. A week's worth of repairs was crammed into 12 hours. As the last bit of daylight faded away, Curtis jumped back into the pilot seat for one final test run. In the darkness, he wasn't able to fly 1,000 meters, but he was able to get the refurbished Junebug off the ground and land it safely. If anything, the plane was now flying better. Faced with the shortage of materials, the group had given the plane a smaller elevating rudder, which actually seemed to make the craft easier to handle in the air. On the eve of the big demonstration, the plane was once again intact and had even accidentally been improved. The plane could fly, there was no doubt about that. But could it fly the distance required to win the trophy? The AEA would have to wait until morning to find out. By 5 a.m. on July 4th, the roads to Hammondsport were already clogged with traffic. The Scientific American Trophy billed itself as the first public demonstration of flight in America, and no one within traveling distance wanted to miss it. By mid-morning, at least 1,000 spectators were spread out across the fields that overlooked the runway. Parents brought picnic baskets. Children frolicked. Couples spread out blankets. A sense of excitement pervaded the entire scene. Reporters, photographers, and even a motion picture crew were set up along the runway, rubbing shoulders with the dapper-looking men who would be the ones to judge the flight. Men like Stanley Y. Beach, the editor of Scientific American, and Simon Lake, inventor of the submarine. Despite the high spirits of the crowd, though, the weather was looking ominous. The threat of rain hung over the morning, and strong winds were scattering the crowd's hats and blankets. Curtis, unlike his first mentor, Captain Baldwin, insisted he wouldn't fly until the weather settled. There was too much at stake to risk another accident. A summer shower slowly passed on through. Still, the crowds kept growing. Few were willing to pass up the first ever opportunity to see an airplane fly. The reporters and judges, though, were much less patient. They had little faith the Junebug would succeed, and begrudged the AEA for the increasingly long and unpleasant wait time. But that day, at roughly 7:30 p.m., Curtis flew the Junebug 5,090 feet, and even the most cynical spectators became instant converts. Alexander Graham Bell's son-in-law, David Fairchild, described the Junebug's flight as the experience of a lifetime. But a moment for the vivid imagination. The thing is done. Man flies. Bell's daughter, Daisy, also wrote about that moment in her diary. Everyone seemed to have lost their heads. They were shouting and cheering and clapping. Engines tooted, and I felt so moved I cried. In front of a crowd of over 1,000 people, Curtis and the AEA had vanquished a problem that had vexed great thinkers throughout the ages. They had opened up a new frontier to human conquest. They had, in short, unlocked the skies. As one journalist would later note, Curtis had done more in that one afternoon to show human flight was possible than the Wright brothers had done since they claimed to have flown over Kitty Hawk 5 years earlier. But while Curtis became an overnight celebrity, the Wright brothers did not sit idly by. On the next episode, we'll see how in the years that followed, the Wright brothers would do everything they could to rewrite aviation's origin story, placing themselves at its center and pushing Curtis out to the margins of history. If you like our series, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One, and every major listening app, as well as at Wondery.com. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast. You'll find the episode notes, including some details you might have missed. And a quick note about these historical recreations you've been hearing. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, so those scenes are dramatizations. But they're based on real historical research. You can find some of the books and articles we found useful in the episode notes. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information about my books on the history of innovation and science, you can visit my website at www.stephenberlinjohnson.com. Sound design on this episode is by Spoke Media. This episode was written by science writer Seth Shulman, based on his book, Unlocking the Sky, from HarperCollins, with editing by Natalie Chicha. Our producer is Emma Cortland, executive produced by Marshall Louie and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.